With sports car racing news and analysis from around the globe, this is the Double Stint Podcast. Here's John DeGeese and Ryan Marine.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to Double Stint, Sports Car 365's sports car racing podcast. Back to our weekly schedule of episodes after some special episodes from Le Mans that John and Dan Lloyd handled quite well while I was on SRO America duty. I am Ryan Marine, John DeGeese on the other side. After the 88th running of the 24 Hours of Le Mans, a strange year, strange race in some respects, but we got it in, and maybe more than anything else when we look back on this year, John, that's what we're going to remember.
Yeah, I think there were a lot of questions, you know, in the build-up to this race. What will happen to it? Will it be delayed? Will it be canceled? Delayed further? You know, will it be canceled? Spectators, yes or no? Ultimately, no spectators, unfortunately, but we got it in, and it was a pretty decent race.
Yes, it was. We'll talk about that here in just a moment. We've got plenty of news to come out of the Le Mans week as well, plus a look ahead at what's another busy weekend of sports car racing coming up this weekend with IMSA Racing at Mid-Ohio and the 48th running of the Nürburgring 24. So a whole lot to cover, a lot to talk about in a relatively short amount of time. We'll dive into the recap here. I suppose I should say, if you want more on the build-up to the race itself, I'd direct you back to not just the website, but also some of the episodes that John and Dan did in the build-up to the 24 Hours of Le Mans itself. But focusing here on the race and the race in LMP1, not a surprise by any stretch of the imagination. Toyota wins once again, the third straight win as well for the number 8 crew, although subtract Fernando Alonso and add Brendan Hartley to that lineup. Impressive for them. More heartbreak, though, for the sister car, which does finish on the overall podium, but just can't find that breakthrough, that number 7 car with turbo issues. What do you make of the Toyota run here in 2020?
Yeah, both cars had issues, and it was kind of surprising that one of them didn't have a flawless run, considering, you know, this has been a tried-and-true package. They've had years and years basically with it, and having gone through a super season with 2 Le Mans with no hybrid competition, and then this year again, and still having some problems. And it was a bit surprising. You know, obviously the number 8 car didn't have too many issues. It was really a puncture in the early opening hour that put them off sequence and pit stops. Okay, not a big deal. But then a couple hours later, it was wheeled to the garage with a brake duct issue. They ended up replacing that on the right front, or was it left front? It doesn't really matter right now. But still, it was some issues there for the number 8 Toyota that ultimately put them a few laps behind. And that gave it clear sailing for the 7 Toyota. And I remember writing the halfway report saying the Toyotas are in control. You know, 7 car looks to be set to win, almost giving them the win there. And it was only half the race complete. And by the time I hit the send button, all of a sudden I saw this number 7 in the garage. And sure enough, that was a huge surprise, especially to have an issue of that magnitude. Remarkably, the team changed the right side turbo in 30 minutes, actually, by the time it was in and out of the garage. And I think that was an unbelievable accomplishment, considering, the magnitude of work dealing with the heat, with the exhaust and everything involved there. Speaking to Pascal Vasselon post-race, the technical director for Toyota via Zoom, he confirmed that it was an exhaust issue that led to the turbo failure, that led them to the changing the turbo. But it was an issue they hadn't really seen in the car at all for quite some time. So it was kind of one of those one-off issues, and it didn't really necessarily concern them for the other car. And that was one of the big questions we had as we were going through the race as well, thinking, you know, could the same issue strike the number 8 car as well? So unfortunately it did not. But unfortunately, in the case of the 7 crew, they came up snake bitten again. And like you said, Ryan, this was the third win in a row for the 8 crew. First time with Brendan Hartley, who replaced Fernando Alonso in the lineup for the full season roster. But the 7 crew of Mike Conway, Kamui Kobayashi, and Jose Maria Lopez can't catch a break. You have to really feel for them.
Yeah, you're almost out of words to describe what they've endured here over the last several years. So fast in qualifying, definitely had, it appeared, the faster race pace as well during the course of the race until the issue, and just never had an opportunity to fully recover from that repair that you detailed. The closest competition outside of the Toyota camp came from Rebellion. Not a surprise there. We knew from looking at the regs coming into this race, this was the best chance that a non-hybrid has had for quite some time to be on something close to even footing with the hybrids, with the Toyotas specifically. And they were closer. We saw early on Bruno Senna with a great start, and he was splitting the two Toyotas there at the start, and it ran that way for a while. They didn't have the deficit with the stint length that they've had in previous editions of the race as well. And yet, in the end, they really weren't able to pose a significant threat, even with both Toyotas having delays at various points along the line.
Yeah, and when you sit back and think about it, I guess it isn't surprising. Even though we had this whole pre-race build-up where Toyota said, oh, Rebellion's going to be right with them the whole race if they don't have a problem, and this and that. And it always sort of comes down to Toyota still having an advantage. Even with whatever EOT you throw at it, whatever changes, the hybrid always has some kind of advantage just through traffic, through the rain. Okay, there was no rain this year for Le Mans, even though there was a threatening chance of it. But it's just not going to end up being a fair fight, especially over 24 hours. And I think Rebellion tried everything possible to do it. They put a lot of effort into this race, obviously there being their last Le Mans outing as we know it right now, and potentially last outing with those cars. They haven't fully decided yet what they're going to be doing for Bahrain in November. They may not take part in that race. So it was a bit bittersweet, but I think that they should be happy with their second place finish. It's the best ever finish for that car, for that package, in this race. And I think it would have been a little sweeter for them if they were able to get a double podium. But then again, the Toyota bounced back in the end after the number three car had its own, the Rebellion, then number three Rebellion had its problems late in the race. So, it's hard to sort of figure out really, you know, if this was a good race or a bad race for Rebellion. I think it was a good race. You're never going to be able to beat Toyota on pace. And even if the number eight Toyota had a little setback early in the race, it wasn't enough to give it to the non-hybrids.
Yeah, it made it pretty darn clear. It painted it in stark terms just what a disadvantage the non-hybrids have and have had for quite some time. If this is the closest they've been, and I believe it is, still to be this far in arrears has to be a little bit frustrating. That said, I do want to take a moment to reflect on the LMP1 era at Le Mans because it comes to a close now. We will see some grandfathered cars, or at least one, with the announcement that Alpine would be running one of the Rebellion chassis, actually, badged as an Alpine looking ahead to next year in grandfathered form. But as far as LMP1 being the top category, it's been a really remarkable ride. We've had some incredible highs. And frankly, the last couple of years have been on the other end of the spectrum. And so I'd be interested in your perspective on the LMP1 era as a whole at Le Mans, but also on this closing portion of that era where the history books will say Toyota won 3 on the trot, but it has to be said against pretty lackluster competition.
Yeah, the wins by Toyota these past 3 years kind of remind me of the early years of Audi when they entered what was LMP900 in those days, which effectively was still the same general formula we have right now with LMP1. And they had really little to no competition through the years. And sure, there were some privateers like Pescarolo, and it took really until Peugeot in 2007 to have a legitimate rival in the class. And I would say that, you know, those first few years, they racked up all those wins at Le Mans, and it made for great marketing, great advertising, really helped push Audi into a new level, first diesel-powered car to win Le Mans, everything like that. So, you know, you look at the accomplishments that Toyota's made, and it shouldn't be with an asterisk on the results. I don't think that's the case at all. I think they really did earn these victories because, you know, we sure they didn't have the competition, but they did race up against some of the toughest competition back in, you know, 2014, 15, 16, when they were up against the Audi and Porsche hybrids. So, you know, if you would have put Toyota, if Toyota had just entered and faced no competition at all through its whole tenure in LMP1, it probably would have been a different story. So, and at the end of the day, it's not their fault that there is no other manufacturer at the moment. And so I would say the last few years, yeah, I'd agree with you, Ryan. They haven't been the greatest. It's been a bit dull at times, and especially with the equivalence of technology and everything associated with that. But I look back at the real highlight of LMP1 was definitely the hybrid, the onset of the hybrid era, 2014, 15, 16, the three-way manufacturer fights. Those were really epic times. And I say it again, but it's something you sort of took for granted it at the time. We didn't realize how good we had it there. And each of those manufacturers were spending, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars, except Toyota really had a smaller budget. But, you know, the amount of money being spent on those programs was insane. And it's something we'll never probably see again, at least in this type of racing. So, those would be my takeaways from the category. Like you said, we're still going to have at least one LMP1 on the grid next year with the Alpine. But for all intents and purposes, this is kind of an end of an era, especially with this year's Le Mans.
And the good news, I suppose, is we do anticipate, and we'll talk about this more a little bit later, that level of manufacturer involvement and competition to come back. Thankfully, not at the elevated budgets that you've detailed, but with LMH coming online and then LMDH a little bit down the road after that, there is some hope that we will see the major manufacturers participating in greater numbers down the road. But this is a bit of a downer swan song for the LMP1 machinery at Le Mans, as far as I'm concerned. To LMP2, however, which was on the other end of the spectrum, I suppose you could pick some nits and say, yeah, well, it was an all Orica show, and that's true. That's also been true for quite some time. Nevertheless, great car count, really great battles throughout the course of this race. And at the end of it, it's United Autosports finally breaking through for that win at Le Mans that they've been coveting for so long. Phil Hansen, Philippe Albuquerque, Paul di Resta teaming up to get the class win. Hansen and Albuquerque win the WEC Championship as well with the victory. This has been a long time coming, and I'd say, John, you know, the one thing you've got to point to is this has been one of the holdout teams with the Ligier for all those years. They make the switch to Orica. We've seen the success they've had in the ELMS and WEC and other races in the build-up to Le Mans, and now they're able to get that breakthrough win as well.
Yeah, I think actually that's a good point on the switch from Ligier to Orica. I think they've only lost one or two races since switching to the Orica, and that's remarkable. They've been undefeated in LMP2 competition since December in Bahrain, both in ELMS and WEC, and it looked for quite a while that they were going to be on track for a 1-2 finish in LMP2 here this past weekend until an oil leak halted the challenge of the number 32 car, which quite frankly was the quicker of the two at times, especially with Joop van Oort at the wheel. He was an exceptionally surprising star in the race. Set the fastest lap in LMP2, had the best 20 lap average over all the competitors in LMP2, and he's a silver rated driver,
yeah,
or at least was silver rated. I think in this edition, I think he actually is a gold now in outside of Le Mans because of the way that the season calendar went with WEC, but that's a whole other story. Nonetheless, it was still a dominant effort by United with this WEC car taking the win. It came a little bit of a scare at the end of the race because the 22 with Phil Hansen had to make a late race splash of fuel. A stop for some fuel, and came out just ahead of Anthony Davidson in the number 38 Jota car. However, Davidson had a pit one lap later. We weren't 100% sure at that time if the Jota car could have made it to the end or not. It turned out they didn't, so it basically gave it clear sailing for United. But what a win for them. They've really turned into a powerhouse team in LMP2, and it's been quite amazing to see through the last 6 months.
What do you make of the Orica domination that we've really seen throughout this generation of LMP2 at Le Mans over the last, what, 4 years now, I suppose?
Yeah, between the Alpine-badged Oricas and then the Oricas themselves, exactly the same car. No big surprise there, quite frankly. This year, there was only a single Dallara and only a handful of Ligiers, so it really was going to come down to an Orica fight anyway. And just looking at the strength of the lineups, there was really no strong lineup from the other constructors because, quite frankly, everybody's already switched to Oricas,
right?
You know, the main contenders like United, like as you pointed out, you know, at one point they were the UK distributor for Ligier, and they realized it just wasn't working, and they had to make the bold move to switch to the rival constructor there and sort of end their relationship with Ligier from a commercial standpoint. But that's when it sort of turned around for them and you know, in terms of the results, and it's really been showing through. The race was really interesting in LMP2. Sure, United dominated, but we still had some strong challengers from Jota. What I found interesting was the Signatec car ended up finishing fourth in class. That was after they pitted on the first lap with a water leak. They were in the garage for quite some time. They ended up rebounding. We also had a car disqualified in the middle of the race, the number 37 Jota Sport entry, the season-long WEC entry. That was actually the Jackie Chan car run by Jota. They ended up getting DQ'd because Gabriel Aubry stopped on track with an apparent electrical issue. Then apparently a crew member went to the car, handed Gabriel a part or some kind of component to get him back to the pits. And per the rules, obviously, any outside assistance is prohibited at Le Mans or in any WEC or ELMS race. So that ended up being an instant exclusion there for that car. And quite surprising because I don't think we've actually seen anything like that in quite a few years. I'm still struggling to figure out the last time that's happened. But quite an interesting one there with the 37 car. And it was a fast paced race for sure, but still good to see United up on the top step.
Definitely well deserved after putting a lot of effort into this race in years past without that breakthrough win. To the GT classes now, GTE Pro, GTE Am, the one common denominator, Aston Martin. It really was Aston's year, and you kind of had a sense even coming into the race that they were going to be awfully strong.
Yeah, they were the pre-race favorites, no doubt, but by the middle of the week, second day of track action, because there was only 2 days of track action before the race itself, but by Friday, you sort of started feeling, well, maybe Porsche has something. And with Jimmy Bruni taking the hyper pole and you know, looking at the pace from the Porsches in some of the sessions, they seemed a bit optimistic. And then all of a sudden, they were nowhere in the race. And it was right from the word go, it looked like they had problems. And ultimately, both Porsches did end up having mechanical issues with power steering failures to both cars and then an electrical issue to one of the others. But they still were nowhere near the pace of the Astons or Ferraris. We saw a better race, I think, in GTE Pro than what it could have been. You know, a lot of people were expecting the Astons just to run away with things. That certainly wasn't the case. The 51A, of course, a Ferrari, put up a really strong fight with the 97 and 95 Astons. The 71 Ferrari was right there too before they had it. They had their own problems. But yeah, it was Aston first win with the new gen Vantage at Le Mans and getting a double win with TF Sport taking top class honors in GTE Am.
Yeah, so congratulations to the driver lineups, Maxime Martin, Alex Lynn, and Harry Tinknell. They were the GTE Pro winning lineup. Then you had in the TF car, Johnny Adam, Charlie Eastwood, and Sally Yolick, which is a cool story. He's been around for a long time, a gentleman driver who really seems to be improving year on year and has been very committed to the sport. And to see him in victory lane at the top step of the podium there at Le Mans, I think that has to be kind of a poignant moment.
Yeah, absolutely. First Turkish driver to win at Le Mans, I believe. So that was a cool thing to see. And one thing I'd like to add as well about the results, we just got this in from the ACO bulletin. All cars were found in compliance with the technical regulations and championship with regards to the items checked.
Yes.
That means there's no post-race penalties.
When's the last time that happened?
First time in eternity, probably,
yeah,
right?
It seems like it.
Every year, every single year, I always remember sitting in the airport hotel in Paris, slaving up until midnight, calling people and figuring things out, because there's always been exclusions or issues or fuel-related controversy or whatever between the last 3 or 4 years. And now it looks, well, we have a final classification, so I guess it is official. So there we go. It's a great thing to see.
That is wonderful news. Maybe it doesn't resonate so much for those who don't cover it, but man, it can be such a headache when everything you write, you just feel is so provisional until this comes in. And that's nice confirmation. So a little bit of news as we record here today. Final thoughts, I suppose, John, on the 88th running of the race. Second time it's been held in September, but by no means were the circumstances of this race precedented in any way, shape, or form. It's one we're going to remember for a long time for a lot of different reasons. What about you?
Yeah, first one I missed in over 10 years, and I'm sure a lot of others, you look at guys like Corvette Racing, Ollie Gavin, at 19 consecutive participations before this race. You can look at a lot of people that have missed this race because of COVID and other reasons. So it was a select few that were there on site, I think about 8,000 people only, according to a statement from the ACO this morning that was issued from Vincent Bumisnil, the sporting director from the ACO. And they ended up having, different bubbles and people couldn't go to certain places. And journalists were restricted to the media center and Zoom calls. And our Dan Lloyd was probably pulling his hair out half the weekend trying to get stories. But we had an extreme amount of content on the site, and really have to tip the hat off to Dan as well, because he did an unbelievable job given the restrictions and challenges there at Le Mans to provide you guys with the best coverage we possibly could given the circumstances. And I think we all just have to hope that the race will happen next June as scheduled, and hopefully COVID will be winding down by then, and we can have a real proper event where everybody can be out and celebrate and have a full field of cars and full attendance from the fans.
I think the word you said right there, celebrate, that's it exactly. If everything goes off like in a pre-2020 year, then there will be quite a celebration next June at the Circuit de la Sarthe. All right, let's quickly mention, we had some other racing, of course, over the weekend. There was the Road to Le Mans races that took place in the build-up to the big race itself. We also had GT World Challenge America powered by AWS, Squadra Corsa sweeping the weekend at Circuit of the Americas, Martin Fuentes and Rodrigo Baptista teaming up to win both races there. A big weekend as well for a couple of Michaels in Pirelli GT4 America, Michael Cooper and Michael Dinan, each winning a bunch of races, each clinching the Pirelli GT4 America Sprint Championships that they are taking part in. Cooper on the pro side, Michael Dinan on the AM side. Congratulations to both of them. We've got full coverage of all of that, plus other races from COTA and more from around the world in the weekly racing roundup. Hope you check that out at sportscar365.com. The 24 Hours of Le Mans itself is always big news, but the build-up to it seems like it's always full of big industry news, and that was definitely the case once again this year, John. So let's start with some on the latest on the hypercar and LMDH front, because we finally did get more of a firm idea, at least, of what to expect. We'll start with the long-awaited and anticipated announcement that Peugeot will be back with an LMH project looking ahead to the 2022 season. It'll be great to have them back on the grid in top-level prototype racing.
Absolutely. They had a big presence at Le Mans over the weekend with some advertising around the track, as well as unveiling their plans for LMH. And Carlos Tavares, the group chairman for the PSA group, waved the tricolor to get the race started. They're definitely all in, and it was really impressive to see the level of commitment they've made, especially during this economic crisis. We have to remember they pulled out of the WEC right at the last minute in 2012, because of their own financial crisis within the company, within the PSA group. And that really left the WEC in a really tough situation. And I think they're in a much better situation now, Peugeot is, you know, to finally enter the WEC after all these years. And we still don't know if it's going to be a full season program in 22, or maybe they'll make their debut mid-year, or maybe make their debut at Le Mans. We don't know for sure. We do know that the car is on track to, is scheduled to be testing in late 2021, and they'll sort of make their decision then. A design study has been underway for quite some time, and they've already finalized the powertrain and a lot of details on that front. So things seem to be moving ahead at a quite a good pace with their new car. It is interesting they've gone the LMH route. You know, we know from our previous talks that they were looking at LMDH, but ultimately the decision was made just to have more styling freedom with LMH, which is surprising because I think a lot of people considered LMDH, you know, has good amount of freedom with the styling cues available. But also the other big reason is that they can, you know, showcase their own hybrid technology with this car. So that's another big factor why they went the LMH route. So good news to see them formally commit. That just came on the heels of Alpine announcing their LMP1 program for next year. Obviously, Alpine is not yet committed to 2022. But we'll have to see whether, you know, LMP1 gets extended for another season, or they're perhaps working on an LMDH program of their own, or an LMH for that matter. There lies a potential, a realistic potential of three manufacturers at Le Mans in 2022. So I never really would have thought that, especially with a lot of these programs sort of getting confirmed or announced amid this pandemic.
Yeah, really good point. Although I think we would have all been quite confident saying Toyota will be there. Not a lot of news necessarily on the Toyota front. However, it was exciting to see the Toyota GR Supersport, which will be, maybe the baseline is saying is going too far, but that's kind of what they're planning their LMH project around. Mm-hmm. It made its public debut at Le Mans on race day, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah. What did you make of that?
Yeah, it was a kind of a surprise little debut. The car, now we should be clear, this is a road car. And
right.
I think some people got confused on social media and even on our site thinking it was like a prototype race car. And no, the race car is not going to be a convertible. this was clearly a road car based on the TSO50 hybrid. So based on their LMP1 car, and basically it'll be a reverse engineer of their LMP1 car is what their Le Mans hypercar will be. So this is the high-end road car hypercar that will be launched in the coming future. Alex Wirtz was driving it around Le Mans, and they used the car as a ceremony for part of the pre-race ceremony of giving the Le Mans trophy back to the ACO. And actually, just 24 hours later, they took it back again. But it was cool to see the car on track, and yeah, it looked a lot different than the initial renders and even the initial prototype version that we saw testing in Japan. It looked a lot smaller to me. Actually, it looked like Alex had, you know, somebody that's, I think he's 6'4" or 6'5", and he barely fit in it if it actually was a hard top. But nonetheless, good to see that car make its public debut. And we'll get more details on the actual race program in early 2021. I spoke to Pascal Vasselon about that, and he said they basically have determined their driver lineup already. That won't be announced until the presentation of the car in early next year. The car will run for the first time next month in a rollout. We don't know where. I asked him where, and he wouldn't reveal it. But Toyota's definitely on track with their Le Mans hypercar race program, and definitely have taken advantage of the downtime from COVID and the change of the calendar as well. Remember that if COVID had not happened, we already would have been into the hypercar era with the start of the 2020-2021 season. This would have been, we would have been just coming off of the first round at Silverstone just a few weeks ago had this whole pandemic not happened and everything got switched around. So it's interesting to sort of take that in the context as well, that Toyota and Glickenhaus and Baikalis have had a good, you know, 6 extra months now to develop their hypercars, and I think all three of them have really needed it.
getting to see that car publicly made some waves for sure. So did some comments from Monsieur Vassalon about the grandfathering process involving LMP1 looking ahead to next year, using specifically for the Alpine group that will be using a grandfathered LMP1 next year. First of all, what did he say, and what are the implications?
Yeah, so Pascal was quite outspoken about what will become the BOP between LMP1, the grandfathered LMP1 car, at least one of them with the Alpine, and the new LMH cars next year. He said that if the two platforms are put on equal terms, it will kill LMH before it even starts. And it caused quite a stir, I think, both, you know, in the industry and in the paddock as well. And it was interesting to see, you know, that Toyota is really holding firm that they don't believe that the LMP1 cars should be put on the same level as the hypercars next year, even though we're going to have a reduced grid, you know, trying to get through what a lot of people are calling it will be a transition year of sorts. It's an interesting one because, you know, ACO president Pierre Fion and both Signatec Alpine team principal Philippe Seignot both have said that they will be on equal terms with Toyota. And so if the ACO president says that, then that means there's an issue there between the ACO and Toyota. And it'll be quite interesting to see what happens in the coming weeks and how this BOP will be determined. I guess that's what it'll be called next year, not EOT. But it's an interesting development for sure. I totally get Toyota's point. You know, what's the point of spending, you know, millions and tens of millions of dollars developing a brand new car where they could have just continued racing their TSO 50 hybrid next year? Obviously, I don't believe hybrids are in the regulations, even grandfathered next year, but that's not the whole point. It's more the principle of this. At the same time, you got to look at a manufacturer like Alpine. You know, they're clearly looking at the future. They're looking to invest in a top-level prototype program, whether that's an LMH or an LMDH, and they need to get their feet wet in the top class one way or another. And the only way to do it next year would be with an LMP1, because it's way too late to go build a LMH car for next year, for instance. So interesting times. It's always a lot of politics involved with this kind of stuff, and I think we'll just have to sort of take a seat and see where this sort of stands in the coming weeks. But it's pretty clear that as of right now, the ACO plans to keep them both on level terms, and Toyota doesn't like it.
Interesting. Well, we'll have to see how that plays out in the years to come. You mentioned Baikalis a little bit ago, and coming off of a rather anonymous into its LMP1 program, it was nice to see the team still has its ambitions of being in the WEC with an LMH project, and we do have a little bit more as far as details about what Dr. Colin Collis and the rest of the team have planned.
Yeah, they revealed some renderings of their LMH car called the PMC Project LMH, and that's apparently a working title. It's not the actual name of the car. They're still working on that. But the car looks quite interesting. It was decked out in the same livery as its LMP1 car. Looks like a hypercar. It's looks like a prototype to me, but with some hypercar styling cues. And the bigger news, I think, is that they're planning to produce track day versions of it and a road car version of it as well. So there's going to be three different models. The road car will be a hybrid, where the race car and track day car won't be, but they'll all be powered by the same V8 normally aspirated engine, producing around 700 horsepower. So Baikalis has pledged to take part in the 2021 season. They've continued their commitment for that. So we're eagerly waiting more details on this, but so far everything seems to be on track and on that front.
Yeah, which is very welcome news. How about on the other side of things? We've talked LMH. Let's go to LMDH and a big and long-awaited announcement at Le Mans about the finalization of LMDH regulations. We had some renderings of what these cars might look like and also a timeline for when we might see them on track competing in championships, specifically in the IMSA WeatherTech Sports Car Championship. What did we learn, John, about LMDH in the future?
Yeah, so basically we got the confirmation of a lot of the regs we had released back in May that came out via a press release. But the biggest confirmations came in terms of the suppliers, the single suppliers for LMDH, both the battery, electric motor, and gearbox. X-Track is going to supply the gearbox to all of the cars in the class, and it's a joint deal with Bosch and Williams Advanced Engineering that will be providing the hybrid powertrain, the motor going to Bosch and the battery going to Williams Advanced Engineering. So that's good to see that all finalized. Also, the cost cap and the prices around this package has been finalized. €345,000 for a rolling chassis, around €300,000 for the hybrid system, and the ACO and IMSA estimate that the total cost for an LMDH car minus the engine and gearbox, just minus the engine, will be around €1 million. So that's $1.18 million. That's not to say an LMDH car is for sale. Obviously, the manufacturers have to make that available for sale, and it'll obviously probably cost more than that when you add the engine, the internal combustion engine to it. But nonetheless, it's good to sort of put some pricing to this formula, especially when you're looking at LMH, that's going to be in the tens of millions of dollars most likely. This is definitely a more affordable concept, and it's been well received by a number of manufacturers, especially ones in IMSA.
One question I suppose I would have, though, is how does that price compare with what is currently being used in IMSA with DPI?
Yeah, it's significantly more. And I know talking to IMSA teams, they were concerned about the cost of the hybrid in particular. Mm-hmm. And, $350,000 for a hybrid system, yeah, that's a real huge expense. But I'm expecting the manufacturers to sort of offset those costs. One interesting thing I did see in the regulations that made it a little easier to swallow is the fact that there will be a spec engine map, spec motor map, or whatever you would call it, for the hybrid system, meaning that teams are not able to modify the hybrid system's software. So talking to a lot of IMSA teams before, they were worried they were going to have to employ an additional engineer to run the hybrid systems. That doesn't appear to be the case now. So that's going to be a way of cost savings there. I think we're definitely going to be looking at a new era in terms of IMSA when these cars do launch. It won't be the same as DPI. It'll be a step above DPI because of the costs surrounding things. But at the same time, I think we can expect a few more manufacturers to join the party.
How about the timeline? First full season in 2023 is what we're hearing. Is that right?
Yeah, and this doesn't come as a huge surprise because we had heard talks of the whole platform being delayed by a year anyway. Although both John Doonan and Pierre Fion have been sort of hesitant to put the word delay on it. Doonan told our Dan Lloyd on site over the weekend that it's technically possible for a car and a manufacturer to debut in the WeatherTech Championship in 2022, but he doesn't see it happening until the latter half of the season, just in terms of the timeline. I think that's more or less down to manufacturers not yet having gotten the green light to develop a car, and it's not a case of IMSA or the ACO delaying the regulations. They'll accommodate the cars in 22, but it's most likely the case where we won't see a full season entrant just because of the timing and everything. Given with the COVID situation, it's delayed a lot of manufacturers' decision-making processes to confirm such a program.
So that's a lot on the IMSA side of things, but how about how LMDH will be integrated into the WEC around LMH?
Yeah, that's still a question mark there, too. The plan is for it to debut in 22 as well, according to Pierre Fion, but we're still waiting to see how the balance will be between these two platforms. IMSA hasn't come out and publicly acknowledged that LMH cars will be eligible in the WeatherTech Championship. John said it's their wish and desire, but they want to see the LMH cars on track, dynoed through in the wind tunnel first. So it's pretty clear that we're going to be seeing LMDH in both series, but now it's a question of whether LMH will be allowed in IMSA and if there's any manufacturers that will be actually interested in doing it anyway. But going back to your question about LMDH in in WEC, I would expect we would see a couple manufacturers at least. But it is interesting to sort of see the tides turn a little bit towards LMH now that Peugeot has confirmed their program there. But then thinking about other possible manufacturers in WEC in the future, you look at somebody like Alpine, I think they would have to do an LMDH. I don't think they'd have the budget to do an LMH. And then you look at somebody like Porsche, who is, I think, close to finalizing an LMDH program. They would obviously run in both categories in both series. So while we've seen some LMH developments, you know, maybe going into that favor, I think the majority of manufacturers, especially in this economic situation, are still going to be looking at an LMDH option instead.
Okay, fascinating times ahead as we get closer to these new regulations coming fully to fruition. How about another topic here? The WEC calendar unveiled over the week there at Le Mans, looking ahead to 2021. Six races on the calendar, kicking off at Sebring. That race in particular, though, probably the one that you look at partially because of the location, partially because of the timeline. You just don't quite know what the reality is going to look like when we get to March. But so we do have the six races as it stands now, but evidently there is a plan B in place in case specifically Sebring proves to not be a possibility.
Yeah, Gerard Nouveau told reporters over the weekend that they have a backup race in place in Europe. That would be 2 or 3 weeks after the planned race at Sebring if they end up having to cancel Sebring due to COVID-19. We don't know the actual venue. I think a lot of people are thinking it's Silverstone, but I highly doubt it's Silverstone. The WEC had a bit of a falling out with Silverstone in terms of the necessary money and sanctioning fees around holding a race there. If I had to put my money on an alternative venue, it would be either Paul Ricard or Portimao, which had been touted as potentially having a race next year on the calendar. That's not the case right now. The six-round WEC calendar is, like you said, provisionally set to kick off at Sebring, then Spa, Le Mans, finally to Monza after initially being on the calendar for the 2021 season. After Monza, then it'll be going to Fuji, then closing out the season in Bahrain. So I think it's a really sensible calendar. But like you said, Ryan, the big question mark is Sebring. And I know there's quite a few teams in the WEC paddock that don't actually feel comfortable starting the new season in America, not just because of COVID, but just being so far away from their base, especially with these, if this will be the first race for the Le Mans hypercars, you know, which would be great for the U.S. audience. And hopefully we have fans. Hopefully the races happen. But it will be a bit strange not to have, you know, traditionally the first race in a calendar year format for WEC has always been at Silverstone or similar in Europe. So we'll have to wait and see what happens. But it's interesting times, and I think a lot of this will be dictated in the coming months over the current coronavirus situation.
The reduction to six rounds, not a big surprise. That is primarily a desire to cut costs, would you say?
Yeah, I think everybody was on board for this. It was kind of floated around in the paddock during the Spa weekend in August, and makes a lot of sense, especially next year, especially if you don't really know how far you could travel. The majority of the races are in Europe again, so that's a good base to work around in case there are travel restrictions. We'll have to wait and see what develops there. I know there's some disappointed people not to be going to places like Kyalami, that was originally on the multi-year calendar, the winter calendar that was scrapped and replaced by the extension of the current season into and then the new calendar next year. But Gerard explained that Kyalami just doesn't really work from a calendar standpoint. You know, you can't have a race in January or December with a calendar year format. So unfortunately, I don't think Kyalami is going to be in the plans anytime soon unless the economy and maybe perhaps the calendar year format goes back to a winter season for WEC.
You can check out the provisional schedule at sportscar365.com. You can also find some other stories, including Audi and BMW. They are committing themselves to the GT-based future of DTM, which we've talked a lot about in previous episodes. We've got compensation weight headed to TCR in IMSA's Michelin Pilot Challenge Series. The unfortunate but not terribly unexpected news that the SRO has had to cancel its GT World Challenge Asia powered by AWS season, And also some news that we will have fans on site, up to 10,000, in fact, for the Indy 8-hour weekend with associated IndyCar races as well as SRO America sports car races. More on those topics and more at sportscar365.com. Finally, a couple of questions to get to before we turn our attention to what's to come this weekend. The first Twitter question comes from at Dr. Joey Bananas, who used the hashtag AskDoubleStint to submit this. He says, is it me, or did the camo GR Supersport unveiled at Le Mans look a lot less weird than the images Toyota revealed last year? And I think you kind of hinted at this earlier, John. You did acknowledge it looked different than the early released images that we saw.
Yeah, it's definitely different, but I wouldn't say it looks less weird. I think it actually looks a little more strange.
Okay.
I don't know. That's just my thought. Maybe it's because it was a convertible and the ground clearance seemed pretty high. Then again, camouflage makes things look strange to begin with at mm-hmm. times. So I'll hold my reservations until we actually see the full car, you know, revealed.
And I'll be honest, I don't remember what the images looked like to. Going back however long ago that was, so I can't really answer that question. But I'm with you. I did think this looked unique, shall we say. It might take a little getting used to, but it might have been the camo, because you're right, that always does make things look a little bit different. I've got a couple questions as well from at RobHurley20 on Twitter, also with the hashtag AskDoubleStint. We'll go with the first one first here, John. With regards to points, he says, and this goes back to our conversation last week on IMSA's new points format looking ahead to next season. He says it's never been better than the old school method from the early F1 days. 9 points for a win, 6 for second, 4 for third, then 3-2-1 for the top 6 finishers, later modified for 10 points to the winner. He says it's easy to understand. Tinkering with the rules is a slippery slope. See NASCAR. What say you?
I agree. I was always a fan of the old F1 point system, and then they modified it to the 25 to win and 18 for second, which is still a big enough margin, you know, when you separate things out. So I don't really, like we said last week, I don't really agree with IMSA's decision to sort of play with the point system and just make it a little more confusing for fans. I would definitely be in favor of adopting an FIA style point system.
Yeah, makes a lot of sense to me too. But I'm willing to let this one play out and see how it works in reality. But simple is better by and large, I think, especially in sports car racing when things are plenty complicated to begin with. Second question from Rob, though. He says, I know BOP isn't going away, but what do you think the series would look like without it in GTLM? Porsche domination, more manufacturers? And he closes by saying a system that penalizes performance seems counterproductive. I'm not sure we would have a GTLM without BOP.
Yeah, I'd agree, because if we didn't have a BOP, I think we would have seen one manufacturer that was clearly ahead of the rest by now with putting the most money into the program.
Yep.
And basically forcing everybody else to leave. So I don't know which manufacturer that would have been. It probably would have been more of a case of a timeline. So take it as far back as you want. You know, 2006, 2007 was kind of the start of BOP, and that was with Corvette and Aston Martin in the GT1 days. So, you know, who had the most money back then? That was Corvette. You know, Aston Martin was on a shoestring with the ProDrive operation at that time. So, you know, I kind of think that BOP saved the class at times. And obviously, GT1 is not the same as what GT2 was, but it's in the same realm of things where you had manufacturers in a GT category. Obviously, Corvette went to GT2, and then GT2 morphed into GTLM, and you sort of see this big cycle. So hard to say. I think BOP has been a good thing for the sport, as difficult as it is for me to say that, because there's a lot of controversy always surrounding it.
I agree. I mean, I think you look at the track record of manufacturers spending themselves into oblivion, causing championships or classes to collapse, whether we're talking about Group C or Class 1 in DTM here recently, or GT1 to some degree. I think we saw that there. I mean, there is a long history, and that's just scratching the surface of it, where the manufacturers, if they feel like they're at a deficit and they're able to make it up by investing in their program, they will do so until it doesn't make sense anymore, and then all of a sudden they pull out and we're left with nothing. So while a system that penalizes performance, like you say, is counterproductive, or I would say maybe more counterintuitive, what it has done is prevented that escalation of cost, at least to the same degree that we've seen in the past. We still have a problem with it. It's something we've talked about with GT3 quite a bit, as a matter of fact. But we definitely would not have as many varieties in terms of shape and type of engine and all, you know, different design philosophies that we have, especially in GT3, which I know is not what you're asking about. But the reason we have so much diversity in GT3, and to some degree over the years in GTE, has been because you can take whatever it is you built and they'll make an even playing field or something close to it for you. And it's imperfect. It's frustrating. It leads to some results that they're not looking for when they put these rules in place. But it's part of the way of doing business. And I don't see any changes coming. I don't think BOP is going anywhere anytime soon. Let's wrap things up here. By the way, thank you for the questions, both to Dr. Joey Bananas and to Rob. And if you have questions for a future show, you can leave them in the comment section of this podcast post at sportscar365.com or use the hashtag AskDoubleStint on Twitter. To the preview here, we'll start with IMSA at Mid-Ohio. That's where you're going to be, John. What do we know going into this event? First of all, it's just great that it's happening because there was some skepticism not so long ago.
Yeah, absolutely. We had confirmation of the IndyCar doubleheader, I think, a couple days before that race actually was even scheduled to begin. So that sort of paved the way for IMSA to be confirmed there with a limited number of spectators, I believe 6,000 this weekend. So that'll be great to see. Mid-Ohio is always a great track for IMSA. A tight and challenging and demanding track for sure. But we've had a couple BOP changes for the weekend. Nothing major, which I think is probably good news in some regards. Both the Cadillac and Mazda get a slight increase in fuel capacity by 3 liters. And then also the Aston Martin and GT Daytona gets a 15-kilo weight break. That's a 30-kilo weight break, actually. So those are the biggest changes right now. Some fuel capacities in GTD as well. But, definitely looking forward to the weekend and seeing how everything will shape up.
And another big race across the pond, back-to-back 24-hour races for the sports car racing faithful. Just got done with Le Mans. Now to another classic circuit, the Nürburgring, where 102 cars are set to take part in the 48th running of the 24 hours at the Nürburgring.
Yeah, I believe it or not, I think it's actually the lowest ever entry in that race, or at least the lowest entry in our recent history.
Yeah.
But still, to have over 100 cars in this day and age, in this current economic and health climate, is quite remarkable. It shows that it shows the dedication of A, the GT3 manufacturers, and B, the true Nürburgring Nordschleife faithfuls that take part in those NLS races and are real true diehard racers. So our Dan Lloyd is en route to Nürburgring as we speak, fresh off of Le Mans, and he'll be there providing all the coverage as usual.
It'll be a busy weekend up on the website. Make sure you're checking it out to stay up with the latest. That, of course, is sportscar365.com. Hey, that's it for us this week. Thank you so much for joining us. We'd love a rating and a review on iTunes if you have a moment to help us out with that. Looking forward to bringing you all the coverage this weekend and talking about it next week with our next edition of Double Stint.